their report suggested that a fellow named Manzer Al-Kassar, a drug dealer, weapons trafficker, and terrorist of international and epic proportions, was involved with U.S. intelligence and was centrally involved, along with the faction of U.S. intelligence that was controlling him, in the actual bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. That report has been widely criticized and officially at least discredited. Personally, I suspect that while there may be some disinformation there, there are also some elements of truth. At the end of the program, I will tell you how to access not only Radio Free America 35, but other archive shows that I've put together over the years. What we're going to look at next is, among other things, an article from the Australian magazine that suggests that the involvement of U.S. intelligence in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 was somewhat less direct, but that nonetheless there is evidence that some elements of U.S. intelligence may be culpable in this particular act and that a cover-up has been going on as a result of that. New attention has emerged on the downing of Pan Am Flight 103 in recent weeks. An article in the San Jose Mercury News from Sunday, July 30th of 1995, has a very brief reference to an article which in turn appeared in the British Guardian newspaper. In the National News in Brief section, Dateline Washington, we read the following short story, headlined, "Report says U.S. had Lockerbie warning." An intelligence report warned the U.S. State Department less than 3 weeks before the 1988 Lockerbie Scotland air disaster that a Palestinian group planned to attack Pan Am, a British newspaper said Saturday. The report raises new questions about the British and U.S. government's insistence that Libya alone was to blame, unquote, The Guardian said. 270 people were killed when Pan Am Flight 103 from London to New York was blown up on December 21, 1988. There have been many accounts similar to that Guardian article alluded to in that San Jose Mercury News article from July 30th of 1995 that, in fact, elements of Western intelligence, both British and U.S. intelligence, had advance warning of the impending bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 and perhaps might have been able to do something to interdict it. The article that we're going to look at next, from the Australian magazine, issue of May 6th and 7th of 1995, suggests that the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 was in fact performed by various Middle Eastern interests operating at the behest of Iran, which in turn was seeking vengeance under Islamic law for the downing of an Iranian airliner by the cruiser USS Vincennes earlier in 1988. This particular article is entitled, "Lockerbie, Is This the Real Story?" The article was authored by Mike Safe, S-A-F-E. Once again, this is from the Australian magazine, the issue of May 6th and 7th, 1995. Research credit on this article goes to Dave White, a fellow who's been sharing his wonderful research with us on this program for a long time. And in characteristically excellent and selfless fashion, Dave has dug this article up for us. The first reference, in fact, let me read the subhead to this article. "For 3 years, the official line has been that two Libyans masterminded the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103, killing everyone on board. Now a sensational television film, denounced in Britain where it is still to be screened, but about to be shown here of course is Australia, claims they are innocent and that the jumbo jet was brought down because a drug run, sanctioned by U.S. intelligence, went wrong. This month, Australian audiences will have the chance to see an extraordinary documentary film challenging the official line that the bombing of a Pan Am jet over Lockerbie, Scotland 6 years ago was masterminded by two Libyans. Denounced and unscreened in Britain, the film blames a drug operation sanctioned by the CIA, but infiltrated by terrorists in the ultimate act of revenge." This particular article, by the way, is also... Actually, the formal title of this is Deadly Power: The Mystery of Flight 103. On the cover, there is the title, "Lockerbie, Is This the Real Story?" So the Australian magazine article of May 6th and 7th of 1995 is entitled formally, "Deadly Power." Actually, no, "Deadly Power Play, The Mystery of Flight 103. The first segment of this article, again, researched for us by Dave White, describes this particular film, The Maltese Double Cross. Skipping down, we read, "In The Maltese Double Cross, American filmmaker Alan Frankovich's 165-minute investigation of the Lockerbie airliner bombing Jafar, that's Khalid Jafar, by the way, a young Lebanese who was apparently working as a mule for controlled drug deliveries by the American Drug Enforcement Administration. Beginning again, in the Maltese double cross, American filmmaker Alan Frankovich's 165-minute investigation of the Lockerbie airliner bombing, Jafar is depicted as the victim of the ultimate deception, a lamb led to the slaughter in the tit-for-tat power plays of Middle East politics and terrorism. In his luggage, probably in the hold of the New York-bound 747 or perhaps in an overhead locker, was a Toshiba radio cassette player. Earlier, in Lebanon, before the start of the journey to his death, the radio had been given to him by a shadowy associate. Jafar, that's capital J-A-A-F-A-R, thought it contained heroin he was supposed to smuggle into the U.S., but it came to hide a bomb. After flying into Frankfurt from Lebanon, Jafar was met by associates of those who had arranged his trip. They took the radio from him and returned it only before he boarded the new flight, the fateful 103. The men Jafar originally dealt with were from Hezbollah, the Party of God, the pro-Iranian fundamentalist Islamic group based in Lebanon. They led him to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command, or PFLP, which was headed by Ahmed Jibril, a Syrian-backed terrorist and bomber. Jafar, didn't know it, the radio was a bomb, says a member of his family. Again quoting, "They gave him drugs to take. Who wants to die? If he knew, he never would have done it," unquote. Indeed, the fun-loving Jafar was anything but a political martyr. He loved fast cars and a life to match, regularly moving between the Middle East and the U.S. His father lived in America, and he was able to use both Lebanese and American passports. The next section of the article discusses the interrelationship between a DEA, so-called controlled delivery operation, and the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, which, according to the account presented here, was using the controlled deliveries of heroin from the Middle East in order to gain political influence in the Middle East with the PFLP. This, in turn, according to this article, in order to gain influence to win the release of U.S. hostages being held by pro-Iranian forces in the Middle East. This section of the article reads, "On the night Jafar flew out of Frankfurt on the Pan Am 747, evocatively named Maid of the Seas for New York, his motives were all about money. Although believing heroin, probably about 2 kilograms, was concealed inside of a radio, he was not afraid of being caught by security or customs. The documentary alleges he was part of a controlled run, unquote, a journey he had made before as a mule or drug carrier under the tacit patronage of the Central Intelligence Agency, the U.S. government's espionage coordinator. The drug runs, where mules were able to bypass normal airport security, came about through a bizarre alliance which was totally against the world order of the day. The filmmakers claim the runs were part of a plot launched by the CIA and supported by its fellow agency, the Drug Enforcement Authority, or DEA, to gain influence over Middle East power brokers such as Hezbollah and the PFLP, whose political clout relied on cash raised through running drugs to the West. At the time, the CIA was desperate to gain a bargaining advantage in trying to free Western hostages held in Lebanon. Hezbollah and the PFLP were quick to realize that playing both sides of the political fence and using the controlled runs, unquote, would reap large risk-free cash rewards. An ex-CIA agent, Oswald LeWinter, that's capital L-E, capital W-I-N-T-E-R, claims the U.S. operation was part of an ongoing deception. He says that as early as 1984, he was instructed by Oliver North, the Marine colonel later to be implicated in the Iran-Contra affair, to set up a dirty tricks operation that would point any blame for Middle East drug running at Libya and its boogeyman ruler, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. The next section of the article that we're going to read discusses how the actual executive authorship, I guess one could say, of the Pan Am Flight 103 bombing was Iranian forces, in turn seeking revenge for the downing of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. cruiser Vincennes, and that, in fact, the Libyans were not behind this particular operation. Also, something we discussed in the aforementioned Radio 3 America number 35 broadcast, there is mention of a German police raid on a PFLP terrorist cell, and that weapons of the type that apparently brought down Pan Am Flight 103 were confiscated, but that one of the bomb makers, a fellow named Marwan Krisat, a name not mentioned here, was released by the German authorities. In the aforementioned Radio Free America number 35, we have examined information that points out that Marwan Krisat was in fact an agent of the BKA, the Bundeskriminalamt, the then West German Federal Police, sort of the equivalent of our FBI. This section of the article reads, "Much of the terrorism that is part and parcel of Middle East politics is as random as it is shocking. But the Lockerbie tragedy was an exactly measured response. 5 months earlier, in July, the U.S. warship the Vincennes, on exercises in the Persian Gulf, accidentally shot down an Iranian Airbus sending 290 people, many of whom were on pilgrimages to Mecca, to their deaths. While the Americans tried to apologize to the world for this massive error, the Iranians planned revenge. It became well known in Middle Eastern intelligence circles that they were offering $10 million for the bringing down of an American aircraft. What was not known was that Ahmed Jibril had taken up the contract." He, by the way, was the operational head of PFLP. Continuing, "This is confirmed by the former president of Iran, Abulhassan Bani Sadra, who tells the filmmakers, quote, 'The people of Iran saw it, the Airbus strike, as a crime. The shooting down of an airplane killing almost 300 people is a crime,' unquote." He goes on to confirm that the Pan Am 103 bombing, quote, "Iran ordered the attack, and Ahmed Jibril carried it out with collaboration from the diplomatic mission," unquote. Jibril had a German bomb-making base in place before Lockerbie. Less than 2 months before Flight 103 was brought down, police raided it, a flat in the Arab quarter of Nus near Frankfurt, where they arrested Jibril's right-hand man and another man described as a Jordanian explosives expert. The ongoing operation, known as Autumn Leaves, resulted in 15 other arrests and, more significantly, the finding of 4 bombs, including at least one hidden inside a Toshiba radio cassette player. It was suspected that other bombs were missing. Despite this, the bomb maker was inexplicably released by a German judge, and he fled to Jordan, although Ahmed Jibril's man remained in jail. The fellow who fled, of course, was the aforementioned Marwan Krisat. The next section of this article on Pan Am Flight 103 shores up information that has previously come out and that in turn was relayed in the Guardian article described in the Mercury News segment with which I began this broadcast, namely that Western intelligence agencies had advance warning that a Pan Am plane was going to be brought down and that indeed some Western diplomats appear to have been able to avoid being on this particular ill-fated flight. One of the article reads, "In November, the month before Lockerbie, British journalist David Yalop went to Libya, where he interviewed Abu Nidal, the notorious Palestinian terrorist who had left a trail of death and destruction across 3 continents. Nidal told Yalop there was growing agitation for him to resume attacks on American targets because of the Airbus catastrophe. Yalop passed this warning to MI6, the British intelligence service, and he believed the CIA was also told. It is claimed that as many as 8 alerts from various sources, including Pan Am itself, the British Department of Transport, the German police, and the U.S. Embassy in Helsinki warned of the bombing of an American airliner flying out of Europe. After Lockerbie, the official British and American response was that those warnings were either not received or they were not detailed enough for thorough investigation. Yalop claims there were warnings that were specific, and one even talked of a flight out of Frankfurt being hit. Quote, what bemused me was that all of a sudden, in our own way, we had given pieces of a very crucial puzzle to intelligence which they had chosen to ignore, or so it seemed. It subsequently became apparent to me, through further inquiries, that they hadn't ignored them. A number of VIPs were pulled off that plane. A number of intelligence operatives were pulled off that plane." So again, interrupting, VIPs and intelligence operatives were pulled off of that particular plane, but not all of them, as we shall see. Continuing, Jim Swire, SWIRE, the British father of one victim, Flora, has emerged as a persistent agitator for an independent inquiry into Lockerbie. He says of the warnings that were not made public, quote, it was only the mugs who weren't on the inside of this system that is supposed to protect innocent people who actually climbed on board that plane, unquote. By the way, the next section of the article refers to the fact that apparently at a time when it figured that every commercial flight headed to the United States from Europe would have been jam-packed, a time when there were still many U.S. military personnel stationed in Europe as part of our NATO contingent, this particular flight, for some reason, was only 60% full. And I think the reason, if it has not already become clear, soon will. Continuing, when the Maid of the Seas took off that night, 174 of its seats were empty, making the passenger load only 60%. This was almost unheard of for a transatlantic flight a few days before Christmas. It should be noted that at the time, 1988, the Berlin Wall was still standing and thousands of American military personnel stationed across Germany as part of NATO were on leave, many of them heading home. Ex-CIA agent Oswald Lewinter reveals that the South African Foreign Affairs Minister of the day, Piet Botha, and a team of negotiators who were working on a Namibian peace deal were booked on Flight 103, but canceled with less than an hour to spare. Botha, now the South African Energy Minister, has categorically denied that he had any warning of the bomb. His version of events was that after flying in from Johannesburg, his team was able to pick up an earlier flight out of London because an original stopover in Frankfurt was canceled. By the way, in the original Radio Free America number 35 that I already alluded to, we also pointed out that Bernt Carlsson, the Swedish UN-appointed administrator for Namibia, was on that flight and did not cancel and died in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. The next section of the article, it refers to the fact that a U.S. intelligence operative, a military intelligence operative named Charles McKee, and some of the members of a team that he was working with to find the U.S. hostages in Lebanon, died on this particular plane. According to this account, and by the way, we dealt with that in Radio Free America 35, according to this particular account, McKee may have become aware of the use of drug running by U.S. intelligence and may have been on his way back to the United States to blow the whistle. This is speculative. Just such an assertion was made in the aforementioned Interfor report. This section of the article reads, two other passengers, both American, who did make the death flight were of particular interest. One was Charles McKee, McKEE, a Special Forces major who was in charge of efforts to free the Middle East hostages. He was angry that U.S. intelligence had resorted to using drug running as a bargaining chip and wanted it stopped. There was speculation McKee was returning home to reveal the scheme to his superiors. It was common knowledge within the intelligence services that he was making the trip. The other American was Matthew Gannon, G-A-N-N-O-N, one of those with whom McKee was probably at odds. Gannon was the CIA's bureau chief in Beirut, close to the hostage and drug action, and he was aboard Flight 103 as a, quote, keeper, unquote, the man officially overseeing the journey of duped drug mule Khaled Jafar. Towards the end of the film, an unidentified American, his face in shadow, telephones an acquaintance, another American said to have worked for the CIA Special Actions Group in Germany. The first man asks the CIA operative, does the name Khaled Jafar mean anything to you? The second man answers, yeah. The conversation goes on. Question, who is that? Answer, he's the local guy, man. You know who he is. Question, what do you mean, local guy? Answer, he's the Lockerbie man. They then discuss how the CIA helped Jafar off the plane on his arrival in Frankfurt and then back on for his departure on Flight 103. Question, when he was taken back to get on the plane to leave the country, who took him through security? Answer, we did. We took him on the plane and turned him over to Gannon. Question, you mean Gannon was his keeper on the plane? Answer, that's right. Question, no expletive deleted. Answer, that's right. The big mother effer was sitting right up there. The next section of the article discusses the fact that after Pan Am Flight 103 crashed or was blown out of the sky, it appears that not only did U.S. intelligence get on the scene of the crash in an extraordinarily short period of time, but that they were also rearranging some of the debris and the bodies, apparently looking for information and perhaps actually moving bodies around at the crash site. This section of the article reads, when the fiery debris of Maid of the Seas rained from the night sky onto and around Lockerbie, there was, of course, confusion and panic. But as the chilling night and its 30-knot winds wore on, there was also mystery. Tam Dalyell, D-A-L-Y-E-L-L, a Labour Party MP who has worked inexhaustibly for the families of the victims, says the local police were surprised with the speed at which a number of Americans, many with no apparent accreditation, arrived at the scene. Quote, they, the police, were concerned with these swarms of Americans fiddling with bodies and tampering with those things the police were checking themselves. I'm not pretending they said they were the FBI or the CIA. They were just Americans who seemed to have arrived extremely quickly. It was very odd and strange that so many people should be involved in moving bodies, looking at luggage, who were not members of the investigating force. What were they looking for so carefully? This was not just searching desperately for loved ones. It was more than that. It was careful examination of baggage, indeed, bodies, unquote. Dr. David Fieldhouse, a police surgeon and one of the first to start authorized marking of bodies, worked his way through one section of the crash site. Using white labels, the only identification tags he had, Fieldhouse found and marked 58 bodies, a grisly task not helped by the dark and confusion. He was to be surprised, quote, "When the bodies were taken to the mortuary, all the labels I had put on them had been removed with the exception of two," unquote. He still has no idea why. Matthew Gannon, the CIA Beirut's bureau chief, who was seated in business class at the front of the 70-meter-long jumbo jet while the drug mule Jafar was at the back. "Yet, when the bodies were officially identified after the crash, they were close to one another. No other persons from different sections of the plane were found in such a way." Obviously, that suggests the distinct possibility that these unidentified Americans, in all probability U.S. intelligence operatives, had deliberately moved Gannon close to the body of Jafar. The last segment of this article that we're going to read in this broadcast concerns allegations that former CIA counterterrorist specialist Vincent Canestrero was given the job of blowing smoke with regard to the truth concerning of Pan Am Flight 103. The claim is made here that Vincent Canestrero was actually involved in the Pan Am 103 investigation in a damage control capacity to hide the embarrassing involvement of U.S. intelligence in the series of events that brought down Pan Am Flight 103. As the investigation into the bombing wore on, the CIA's role was handed over to Vincent Canestrero, the then U.S. National Security Council's head of Libyan policy. The outspoken former CIA agent Oscar LeWinter, it's actually Oswald LeWinter, derides this appointment. Quote, "What's that famous saying about putting the fox in charge of the chicken coop? For Vincent Canestrero to be put in charge of investigating Lockerbie would be funny if it was not an obscenity," unquote. LeWinter claims Canestrero's job was to make Libya and Colonel Gaddafi look the villains, not Iran, which was known to have offered millions of dollars to avenge the Airbus attack, nor Syria, which exerted considerable influence over the fate of the Western hostages. By the way, I would also note there are those who view Mr. LeWinter's credibility as being less than 100%. He was, by his own admission, involved in a CIA disinformation campaign with regard to the so-called October Surprise, the apparent deal cut between the Reagan and Bush campaigns and the Khomeini forces in Iran to withhold the U.S. hostages taken from the U.S. embassy in Tehran until after Jimmy Carter's humiliation and consequent election defeat were assured. By the way, in Radio Free America program number 38, we examined the landmark research of Farah Mansour, a member of the Iranian resistance, who has developed a very compelling operation that although the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces were indeed in bed together, there was no deal cut during the campaign, but rather that collaboration was the outgrowth of a huge U.S. covert operation begun in the 1970s. Check Radio Free America number 38 for the details concerning that particular scenario, and also for Farah's landmark research, copiously documented. As we prepare to wind up this segment, it appears that there certainly was a role, according to many sources, by elements of U.S. intelligence in the circumstances surrounding Pan Am Flight 103. If they did not, in fact, know that the plane was going to be bombed, certainly there is evidence that elements of U.S. intelligence were involved in drug smuggling, and that perhaps was what was deemed necessary to cover up in connection with the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. As I mentioned, in connection with the Radio Free America broadcasts, all of the archive shows that I've put together over the years, radio documentaries in which printed sources are read on the air, literally extracted on the air, much as the Australian magazine article I just read was presented, I put together these documentaries so that listeners can tape the programs and then use the resulting tapes as an audio study resource. All of these archive shows are on permanent file with a tape duplication service. More about that right now.
Tape cassettes of Dave Emery's archive documentaries and weekly One Step Beyond programs are available from a tape duplication service. The service is Archives on Audio, and you can contact them at Post Office Box 170023, San Francisco, California, 94117-0023. The phone number is area code 415-346-1840. Once again, that's P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, California, 94117-0023. The phone number and area code are 415-346-1840. A 12-page catalog listing and describing each archive show is available.
By the way, that's now a 19-page catalog, and neither myself nor the station get money out of this arrangement. The home-based station on which I produce these programs, KFJC-FM in Northern California, has its own page on the World Wide Web. Those of you who would like to find out more about Archives on Audio and the archive shows can access the catalog program descriptions, as well as a suggested reading list and other references for good information on the subjects that I cover on these programs on the KFJC World Wide Web page. More about that right now.
KFJC is available on the World Wide Web. Simply point your web browser at http://www.cygnus.com/misc/KFJC. Spelling that out for you using all lowercase letters, http://www.cygnus.com/misc/KFJC. We remain your source for sound information.
Again, the KFJC webpage has all of the program descriptions and cross-references with other programs containing similar or related material. On this program, we've dealt with a short article from the San Jose Mercury News from Sunday, July 30th of 1995, entitled "Report Says U.S. Had Lockerbie Warning." That, in turn, from a British Guardian article on July 29th, or at least according to that story. And also, we've dealt with an article from the Australian magazine, their issue of May 6th and 7th of 1995. The article is called "Deadly Power Play: The Mystery of Flight 103" by Mike Safe, S-A-F-E. This concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.